Welcome to Directionally Correct, a People Analytics podcast with Cole and Scott. Today's guest, Mark Hansen, VP of Strategy, Skills, and People Analytics at Lightcast.
Thanks to our sponsors, Lightcast. The world is full of talent data, but more data can lead to more questions, uncertainty, and stagnation as organizations sift through it to figure out what's fact from what's fiction. Lightcast's talent intelligence platform answers your most difficult workforce questions to drive meaningful business results. With more than 20 years of experience as MCM Burning Glass, Lightcast accelerates your work, bringing together hundreds of billions of vetted, constantly updated data points and incredible insights to drive strategic talent decisions. Your organization can tap into the deepest open repository of skills, supply, and demand data in the world to transform your hunches into a skills-based future for your organization. Lightcast's flexible solution, used by 67 of the Fortune 100, can integrate your own data, be guided by in-house talent experts, and give you the tools and confidence to explore it for yourself. To learn more, book a demo at lightcast.io. All opinions are our own and do not reflect those of any other organization.
But this girl is just out there practicing pickleball. And I know it's like people practice tennis, but it seemed really odd that someone would practice pickleball. And that feels like a sport you take up when you want to give up.
Did she have, because when you practice tennis by yourself, they have the machine that shoots balls at you. Did she have a machine that shoots pickleballs at her?
No, apparently I need to paint a better picture for you. So she is there and she had like 10 pickleballs by her and she's just serving over and over.
Really?
Yeah, just, okay, yeah, it's weird, right?
I always saw pickleball as like a drinking sport. Not like a sport that you do to like, I'm going to have the best serve in history.
Exactly. This is what old people play. This is what you play when like you just want to have a beer, but play tennis.
Like everybody I know that does it, they do it just to have fun. Not like because they're going to be on like the competitive world championships of pickleball.
I mean, maybe she wants to dominate her friends or whatever. But that it doesn't feel like the spirit of the sport, right? It's like doping. It's like doping in the baseball. It's like, what, you're practicing? What the fuck? Practicing?
This brings up a good point. What sports would steroids not help you succeed in? I don't think steroids help you succeed in pickleball.
A little road rage? Not road rage, just rage. Roid rage?
Yeah, I think it's probably to your detriment even, maybe.
Performance de-enhancer.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a curling guy, right? Maybe curling?
Well, I mean, it does require some strength and the flexibility. I mean, I don't think steroids make you more flexible, but definitely the strength component probably would help.
You shoot that ice block to the other end of the rink, out the backside.
I remember seeing this documentary about the Russian athletes who used to dope.
Yeah.
And I think they said the only group that it didn't benefit, I think, was like the female ice skaters for some reason. I'm not sure why. Maybe I'm making that up.
I guess you can't be too muscle. You probably get muscle bound, right? I don't know.
Like it would help the gymnasts, right? It would help the people who do the track and field. Pretty much everything in track and field would be enhanced by it. I just think like any kind of finesse sport, like ping pong probably wouldn't be helped. You know, like
so ridiculous. Think of this guy just totally ripped playing ping pong. Man, shed a lot of tears on that green wood.
Yeah. Like pool. Maybe pool wouldn't be impacted by it because that's like a finesse sport.
Billiards.
Yeah, billiards. What are some other it's got to be something that, you know, is more of a game of skill than a game of strength.
Yeah, is billiards a sport? I mean, it's probably an Olympic sport or an Olympic game, right?
Well, it used to be one of those that. You know, I know that channel I don't think ever really existed except during the pandemic, but like ESPN, the Ocho, have billiards on like late at night. That was actually fun to watch. And like poker, like all those kind of things were fun, is like just something to kill the time.
Who did we talk to the other day? Because, it was Andrew Pitts. And I used to watch Australian Rules Football on the Ocho.
Like, what is... I don't even know if I know what that is. What is Australian Rules Football?
Damn it, we should have brought this up. It's a cross between, say, like, rugby. It's very much like rugby. It's like rugby and hurling. If you've ever watched Irish hurling.
I've never watched Irish hurling either.
It's played on an oval, all right? It's like an oval thing. And it's kind of like you like kick the ball and like you try and kick it through one of three goals. And you get 1 point for the edge goal and you get 6 for the middle.
Okay.
What's well, up,
I
Mark?
Learned something today. Do you know, Mark, do you know what Irish hurling is or what Australian rules football is?
I briefly knew about Australia, but the hurling one, I don't know.
Hurling is amazing. So imagine you have a soccer pitch and you have a soccer goal on each side, this traditional setup. And on top of the soccer goals, you have like American football field goals.
Nice.
And they give you like a little, I don't know, it looks like a not like a racket ball, but it's like a lacrosse ball, and this, it's like a paddle, and yeah. Everyone runs around and like smacks the shit out of this ball and tries to get it either in the goal or through the uprights.
That's amazing.
I think it's one of those rugby. You have to see it.
It's worth a YouTube. It's okay. Definitely worth a YouTube.
Yeah. I like the wife throwing competition better. That one.
I have seen that. Now that is fascinating.
That's Scotland, right?
Yeah.
The Scottish games, they throw their wives? Like where? Like in the river?
I have no idea. Yeah, it's a hot topic in Scotland, apparently.
Well, and Mark, I think you're of Swedish heritage. Are there any kind of games or things that are culturally accustomed to Sweden that, you know, are like throwing your wife?
There's an ancient game. It's actually caught on in the Midwest, and now it's like a crazy international fate. If you ever heard of Kubb, K-U-B-B?
Kubb.
No. Yeah. Now it's super popular in Minnesota. There's like leagues and there's like a national Kubb tournament that's based in like Wisconsin every year. But basically you put up these little wood posts and you put like five on each side. And then there's like a bigger post in the middle they call the king. And you throw little short wooden dowels at your opponent. So you basically, I think it's teams of four or six line up on each side and they line up these and you throw the sticks at each other's. And when you knock down the king, you win. So that's like our favorite, like everybody in Minnesota has a cabin up north, up because we have 10,000 lakes. So when we go up there, that's like the kids' favorite game to play in the summer is Kubb. So yeah, everybody's so this got is like
a precursor to beer pong, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Like an ancient Viking Swedish game developed probably over some ales. So yeah.
I thought you were going to say like the ancient Swedish game of like trying to put together the coffee table using all the instructions.
Exactly. With one little tool. Yeah.
with an Allen wrench.
Yeah. Yes, we're trying to talk about games, Scott, that you can win here. That's an unwinnable game.
That's a destroyer of marriages game right there.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's fascinating.
But Minnesota, well, man. Like, that's.
No.
I love the accent.
So is it one of those things that you can turn on and turn off, Mark? Or is it like you've always got some Minnesota in your back pocket ready to, you know, spray on somebody?
I have to turn it on all the time when on customer calls, my colleagues make me do it. They're like, speak Minnesotan to us. And I was like, okay, I have to. And I was like, oh, you betcha. Here we go. You know, so yeah, we can turn it on pretty well, but.
Oh, you betcha. Weird little fella.
Weird.
Yeah.
Gotta get some
Fargo for you.
Yeah, it's Fargo. Yeah. Fargo's kind of a weird one though. They mix in a lot of Canadian sort of accent, and that's not true Scandinavian Minnesotan. So
It's like an East Coast, West Coast rap battle for sure.
Exactly. It really is. We have a general healthy dislike of each other with Canadians in Minnesota. We're just too close to each other. So.
Who's better at hockey? Who's better at football?
Ooh, for sure football. Hockey's a tough one, though, because Minnesota is the state of hockey. So I think we could go head-to-head with most Canadians pretty well. But nice. I think we're the only state to be able to say that. But
absolutely.
Also, most of our hockey players on all the Minnesota teams come from Canada. So it's
can't beat them, join them, right?
Yeah, we're all in the mix now. So yeah.
Fascinating. Well, Mark, I think of you. So we met last year at Tal Reyes, and you graciously invited me to come to the Lightcast conference, which I was very, honored to get a chance to speak at. But I think of you as a skills guy. Is that a fair characterization, or what? Tell us a little bit about your background in people analytics, and then what role, what you're doing now with skills and at Lightcast is.
Yeah, so I'm a skills convert coming from people analytics. And I also can't claim to be pure people analytics too. I stumbled backwards into that as well, but ended up absolutely loving it. And so my heart's probably in people analytics, but skills is my new passion and what I get excited to talk about a lot. Quick on my background is I started my career in financial planning, and I quickly ran far away, went and got my MBA. I did a full-time MBA program. And I met some awesome folks that were like, consulting is the way to go. So a bunch of us went into management consulting, did that for 5 years. And I was like, this is really fun, but it's also a grind. Yeah. And lots
and you got the sweater vest to prove it. So
I know. I got the finance bro thing going. That's where I picked it up from. But then one of my buddies calls me out of the blue, and he's like, is a guy I played on the college golf team with. And he's like, hey, I work at United Health Group. I'm on this people analytics team. He's like, I have these awesome analysts. They know how to work with data. They don't know how to pick up the phone and talk to an executive about how to use data, what their problems are. Can we address their problems with data? He's like, can I use your consulting skills to, and I was like, well, I can talk all day long, but I know nothing about analytics. Like we were doing, some cool stuff with, financial modeling and different things like that. But like pure people analytics, I didn't even know what that subject was. And so he's like, oh, I'll teach you all that. He's like, I just need somebody that can speak to leadership. And I was like, okay, I can do that. So I came over and basically started my career as a liaison between senior leaders, HR leaders in talent management and talent acquisition, and all the people that report to the CHRO saying, hey, we have big problems with turnover. We have big problems with hiring. We have big problems with site selection. What data can you show me that we can make better decisions? And so I got fully ingrained in the world of people analytics and working with all of our data teams and our data science team and some just amazing folks here in Minnesota at the headquarters of United Health Group. And all of a sudden somebody comes to us and is like, hey, we should start a talent intelligence function. And I was like, oh, what's talent intelligence? That sounds interesting. And then they said, well, it's basically bringing in external data to mix with our internal data. And we need a bunch of it because we are tapping out entire labor markets with our hiring. At the time, United Health had like 350,000 employees. We were getting over 6 million applicants a year. And there are certain markets it was impossible to hire in. We couldn't grow. And so they came back and said, hey, we want to pull somebody from the people analytics team and a person from the sourcing team. And we want you guys to collaborate to figure out how do we answer some of these hiring questions and look at all the markets that we're trying to hire. And so that started a journey of starting the talent intelligence function at UHG. And it just exploded from there. So I got introduced to Lightcast and all these other cool vendors that are doing stuff with external labor market information, and just did a crash course for 3 years of building that team. And then ended up getting promoted a few times up to fully leading the people analytics team before I left. And then I got a little too cozy with Lightcast and jumped over to their side, kind of a cold napper route a little bit, but well, who knows? Maybe I'll be compelled to go back into the business someday, but right now it's fun. So I get the pleasure of leading our skills strategy, but still do a lot with the people analytics team just because that's where my heart is. So
how does it work? If someone is interested in using Lightcast, they come to you with a general idea of where their organization should be going, and you match them with a skills library. How does it all work?
Yeah, it's even broader than that. It's like, hey, we're having trouble hiring. We don't know where to open our next office or our next call center. You know, we don't know what to pay people. Like, hey, we're thinking about doing diversity benchmarking. Do you guys have diversity data? So it's like, yeah, we have all the data and we can tell you things about skills. We can tell you things about, you know, comp benchmarks and diversity benchmarks, whatever you're trying to look at. But I'd say most often it's coming from, where do I find the talent? What should I be looking for? I got this vague job title, so I almost need to do a skill search. Can you guys help us do a skill search on kind of the skill sets that I need? And luckily, all of our data is set up really well to do that and be able to scan the market to say, well, you know, here's who's competing in all these markets. Here's where there's, you know, good population of people working in those. Here's where, you know, you want to watch out for, you know, these economic factors in this market. But in general, like, these are better markets than others. So we try to help them build the right formulas to say, what should I be doing with my talent?
Yeah.
Where should I go? So that's been really fun to be able to mix the awesome data that is floating in all of the internal systems within organizations. But how do we bring context to that internal data where we can have an outside view so we can get that 360 degree view of talent and our competition and who's out there in the world so that it helps enhance all of the talent strategies. And so, yeah, we use that in a whole variety of use cases. But yeah, that's the general, is like, how do we just broaden out our perspective, because a lot of companies get really insular and there's a lot of good data to glean from that. I mean, most companies have done that for, you know, many, many years of just looking at their internal data and making smart decisions. But we believe that you can make even smarter decisions if you're looking outside as well.
Oh, absolutely. It's a kind of a dream come true for an organization where, you know, you need to hire people and you need to kind of go where those people are, right? So you can rely on Lightcast. But I mean, there's also like a fluidness to the sort of skills that are needed in the future. Is there a way to sort of pinpoint, or are you seeing certain skills popping up as being more desirable?
Yeah, absolutely. As we map, our goal is to map the entire labor market globally with skills and titles and occupations and be able to trend that and build crazy fun ontologies and knowledge.
I love this. This is great.
And so, yeah, so that's our goal. And so we ingest over 10 million job postings every single night from around the globe. So it gives us a wonderful picture into what are companies looking for? What are the new skills terms that they're using? Where are they asking for this talent? What experience are they asking for? What unique skill sets are they combining together? What's the title that they're using? Because every company uses a crazy unique title for different reasons. And so we are mapping about 200 facets of data on every single job posting that comes through, and then putting that in structure. And so we're obviously using some really cool, you know, machine learning and large language model, you know, processing to be able to classify all this data. But it's really about kind of the solid taxonomies that we use to be able to compare apples to apples across the globe. But more importantly, like you said, like what is popping up? What's trending? Where are the new skills? Like when prompt engineering popped up because everyone's talking about ChatGPT, we immediately added that as a skill into our library, and we updated every 2 weeks, but then we reflow all of our historical data sets. So we can look back in history to say, when did prompt engineering actually show up in job postings? What jobs was that asking for? And it was all over the place. It was writers and marketing and, you know, and of course all your normal data science and engineering sort of roles, but there's these pockets of occupations where like, oh wow, that actually landed in a whole bunch of other areas that we didn't even think about. And then we can watch that trend, and the trend of prompt engineering is just like a hockey stick. It's really fun to see. But yeah, what's the mix? What's the mix of industries? What's the mix of companies that are working on that? And so that's what kind of is cool about this daily changing data and being able to map that in real time. And then, of course, we want to look at the supply, who has those skills, but that data moves a little bit slower.
Of course.
Well, just to take a side detour here for a second, I mean, I feel like Lightcast, you guys' data repository is just phenomenal. And I personally am a huge fan of a lot of the work that is done in talent intelligence using this type of data. And you mentioned a second ago, like wanting Lightcast to basically have every piece of that type of data globally. What's the last mile problem of getting to that end, right? Yeah. Of having every piece, like what's missing is the question, because I feel like you guys are right there on the forefront of having every piece of data that is available. What's the thing that's missing out there?
Yeah, it's really just access to data. So when you go outside the US, the UK, Canada, like we are so spoiled with how much data we have access to and how well it's been organized for many years. And then we're also spoiled with really cool dominant players like LinkedIn and some big job boards like Indeed and others, where a lot of data is pretty centralized. So we don't have to go to that many places to find, you know, good data. When you start going internationally, that data quickly drops. Like,
oh yeah,
the India census, the last time that was updated was like 20 years ago. And then they don't have any great occupation categories or anything to be looking at. And then they have like 30 popular job boards. And then, so I would say the biggest one is just like availability of data. And then of course, language is always a barrier. How do we get into all of the nuances mm-hmm. of the different languages for that people post jobs in, that talk about themselves on resumes? How do we do all that translation really well? We're fortunate to have a really cool NLP modeling team that's doing, you know, machine translation work and building some cool models to get over that barrier, because there's a lot of the translation tools don't really work on jobs. It works for conversational sort of language, but not kind of technical language. And so we're deep into that world and adding new countries every year. But that's the last mile, is how do we effectively gather that data, find that data, categorize that data appropriately, and have that kind of that deep, rich translation that actually means what it means versus us just doing a Google Translate, which is often not accurate. So
do you feed this information back to job seekers? I mean, it seems exceptionally valuable to, say, the individual job seeker, or universities. Like, here's the sort of skills that are going to be needed in the next 2 years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Teach those.
So that's actually the two biggest parts of our business are enterprise consulting firms, and what we call talent in our world. And then the other side is higher ed and all of the community yeah. colleges and universities. And so, yeah, we have thousands of schools that are customers, and that's exactly what they want. They're like, what are the skills in demand? How do we switch our programs so that we remain relevant? Because they're marketing, you know, they need to stay in existence. They need customers. Their customers are students. If they don't have any relevant things to train, they don't stay in business. And so we try to work with those two groups. And then the other third part is what we call government or community, which is all the surrounding government customers. Think of workforce planning boards, economic development groups, unemployment offices. And really, we see that as a Venn diagram of bringing all of those groups together. So if educators are talking to employers and they know how to change their programs, and the local governments are talking to the employers and the educators, if they're all working from the same data and singing from the same song sheet, they can all coordinate the right tax incentives, the right ways to lure new businesses in, the right ways to incentivize and retain talent in these local markets. And then the hope is that everybody prospers in that exchange of really quality data. So that's actually the roots of our two founding companies, which was Burning Glass Technologies and MZ, were our old names, and we combined a couple of years ago and rebranded to Lightcast. But we've been doing this for 23 years and 21 years, something like that, respectively, between the two old companies that came together. And so we're no strangers to this, of gathering this data, and that is the hope, that we can just continue to expand globally, bring the governments and educators and employers together to find just create new opportunities in the marketplace for everybody. So I love the mission. I love what we do. It's been a fun ride for the last 5 years.
Well, let's pivot back to skills here for a minute. So educate us real quick. What is a skills-based organization, and why should organizations adopt that?
Yeah, this is a hot topic right now. It's been going for a couple of years. Obviously, skills isn't new. Like, everybody's been talking about it. We've had competency models for years. We've had, you know, knowledge, skills, and abilities on ONET, you know, that people love to talk about. I mean, that's been around for decades. So as we think about a skills-based approach, it's really going one layer deeper underneath vague job titles and just vague job descriptions of what companies are using today. That model has worked for many years, but now as we need to refine our approach to managing talent, we need to get one level deeper into understanding the granularity of, like, what makes up a job? What do we need to deploy to actually make, you know, our company work? You know, how do we start to see the demand for skills that we need to run our company effectively? And then how do we analyze the people sitting in those jobs? What used to work between, you know, high level interviews and, you know, finding somebody that's eager to work and they meet basic requirements, that's great. But now, as new technology is developing, as new you know, what we love to talk about from our economics team is the global talent is shrinking. And so we don't have this massive pool of people anymore. So we need to start getting more precise with how we screen people, how we match people to jobs, how are we effectively assessing them, how are we moving talent around, and more importantly, how are we thinking about the future of work? That's what excites me the most. It's like, you have things like ChatGPT. Well, it's opened up thousands of new types of jobs out of thin air, because now people, anybody can jump on their computer and start learning ChatGPT and kind of the basics of large language models and how do I write better prompts? And there's all these educating. Well, all the ancillary tools that are coming alongside that to start new businesses, like brand new jobs are being created. And almost everybody in our company is using some version of ChatGPT across all of it. So it's changed how we work and how effective works it. And those be able to break that down from vague language to more precise language is where we see companies wanting to go, so mm-hmm. that their talent management strategies can get more precise. Because that's the challenge right now is I can't afford to go buy people in the market. So how do I prioritize and how do I target the right learning, which we call build talent strategy. And then which of my jobs can be automated? Can I take advantage of this? So we call it the bot strategy. And then where do we borrow talent when it's too expensive and we just need contingent labor? So when we can get one level deeper into that precision language of skills, that allows us to do the build, buy, borrow, bot talent management strategies much more effectively. And we can track that more easily. Now, I have to preface, skills doesn't solve everything. We still need so many other mechanisms. We need to still have interviews. We still need to have assessments. We still need to have, ways that,
you got to measure those skills some way, yes, right? Yeah,
we need competency models. Skills do not replace competency models. They don't replace your hiring practices. Like, I think two people go a little bit too far and like, oh, skills is this, you know, utopia. And I'm like, oh, no.
They're always saying that. They're like,
no, oh, I was like, no, you guys like, no, skills is a mechanism. It's a wonderful mechanism for connecting learning and work. I haven't found a better one. I'm actually curious if you guys have ideas of like, what is a better mechanism to use? Because I've racked my brain for 5 years on this subject. And I was like,
a better mechanism. So when I think of skills, like organizations pay people to do things. You need someone to fix your computer. You need someone to run your NLP. You need someone to lead a team. These are skills, and they're proximal to the outcome that you desire, right? The only sort of problem with that is that if they get too narrow, then you know they're subject to change, and you know this sort of thing, where you may need a broader sort of like taxonomy or competency sort of model approach. Otherwise, like you're going to like sort of like aptitudes, like mechanical aptitude or these sort of things that would be a little bit more fungible, but not quite so much. But that's kind of like devil's advocate. Clearly, you need to get to those specific things that people can do to fill a specific job function.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I'll say this, like, I know we sent this over to you earlier,
yeah,
from the Talent Strategy Group and Mark Efron and all of them, about an article about is it worth the squeeze? You know, is the juice worth the squeeze in becoming a skills-based organization? And I've actually thought a lot about this, Mark, in terms of, you know, what is my negative reaction to some of the folks that are doing the work in this space? And really, it's not the perspective that you've brought to us at all. Mm. I think it was a combination of who was actually communicating it and how it was portrayed.
You just don't like who the messenger is?
Well, I thought they were just, you know, blowing smoke.
Yep.
And the other thing is that they were painting it as a panacea, as a cure-all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're selling snake oil, you know, I'm not really a big fan of that.
Yep.
But I see what you all are doing as kind of a balance there, because to your actual question of like, what is it? I just think back, you know, I very rarely put on my full IO psychology hat.
Yeah.
But I think about like job analysis and you mentioned, you know, KSAOs earlier. So knowledge, skills, ability, and other characteristics.
Yep.
And the thing that I think, it's not that I have a problem with skills is the S, right? Yeah. It's that if you solely focus on the S, what are you leaving out? Yeah. And I see the combination of all those other things as what I would call talent. Right. And so it's like there's this war between the historical version of like we focus on things like talent. And now the focus isn't on talent anymore. And it's only just going to be every job is going to be decomposed. All you are as a human being is a collection of skills. You're no longer a role. And I'm just not about that. That's not the future that I think that I want to see. But also, I just don't think it's realistic from a data standpoint either. So I don't know. How do you react to that, Mark?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'd say in 5 years, we might get there to where like the AI in the interpretation of like who I represent myself as, like through a profile, through my resume, through, you know, whatever I'm information I'm showing within the internal HR systems, could do some interpretation to be able to match me to the right things. But we're not quite there yet, because the models aren't quite there. The meaning behind connecting things isn't quite there. My goal with this is to say, how do we enable better development conversations for our employees? Right now, there is not a great mechanism. Some companies have done this well, but I want to go to my manager and say, what are the skills that I need to learn to be successful in my job? And most managers today would have a trouble finding the right words to say. They might pick some competencies like, oh, you should get better at, you know, executive presenting and, you know, doing presentations, or you might need to be more politically savvy or something like that. It's like, okay, those are great. But like, no, what is there a technical skill that I need to learn that actually could advance me in my career? And they're usually stuck. And so my goal of saying, like, if we can get one layer deeper than a vague job title and job description, we can say, here's a list of skills, of tools and technology, some soft skills, some hard skills. They can all be mixed together. It actually doesn't matter. It's just a list of things that you can review with your manager to say, which of these would you prioritize for the situation our team's in right now? And in the current time, our company's, you know, in our growth phase of like, what are we focusing on from a business situation? Is there something I should put my time to? What too often what companies do is they're like, hey, employees, there's a learning system. Go pick some learning. You should learn. Well, nobody does that. Like, nobody's got time to go learn. Like, we're all under the gun all the time in our jobs. And so that just falls flat. But if a manager says, hey, once a month, we're going to check in on your skill development, and I'm going to suggest a couple skills to you. And oh, now let's go search that in the learning system so that you can start showing progress. Well, if you're showing initiative, I'm going to start signing you up for new projects. I'm going to start, you know, throwing new challenges at you, and you can actually see that growth and development. And right now we haven't been able to prove that growth and development. So I'm like, hey, let's just get skills in front of people and see what happens. We don't need to change all of our systems. We don't need to, you know, buy some crazy expensive things off the shelf. There are some ways that we can pull that all together, but that's my goal, is to say, use skills as a connecting tool for manager conversations, for looking at unique career paths and seeing if you're ready for the next one, and directing you to learning. So the connective tissue aspect is where we tend to focus.
Yeah. I have a hypothesis about this, Mark, and I'm curious to get your perspective on it, which is like, why has the skills thing blown up lately? Like, why is it so hot?
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons is because of the diminishment of the perceived value of a college degree.
Yes.
And so like, I don't know if you all are affiliated with them, but I saw earlier this week, the Burning Glass Institute published that 52% of college grads are not working in college related jobs now.
Yep.
And if you look at, you know, how the price of a college degree has gone up much beyond the cost of or above inflation for the general population. And so it seems like the value is going down, the cost is going up. At some point, those two things intersecting, and it's going to break, right? That model of it. And so what is a post college credential for every job model that we've had for a long time? What does that look like? And I think people are saying, well, it's going to be a skills-based future. I think that actually makes some sense. But they don't, I've never heard anybody explain it in that way. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's partially that. I think the underlying issue is actually not that degrees aren't worthwhile. It's that it's hard to attribute what that degree actually means. So nobody's broken down that degree to be like, here's the tangible skills you learned in that degree. We've had these complicated crosswalks historically of like, I did this program and got this degree, and so you can do these occupations. And it's the same thing with like career pathing. It's like career pathing was super manual to be like, oh yeah, let's find the logical paths and let's look at the different degree types that could solve all this. So I think it's actually what the reason it's become so popular is because it's a data element that can be measured. So skills are, you know, words that can be counted, words that can be overlapped, and words that can measure gaps. And it's hard to do that with degrees and be able to say, this degree represents this collection of skills. Some areas have been really successful in that. Like, you should never replace degrees for things that are absolutely critical. If you need a nurse anesthetist to do a certain job, you want to be sure that they have a degree in nursing. They have all the certifications in, you know, anesthesia. Like, that encompasses, we don't need to throw 100 skill terms at something like that because it's not useful. Those are already baked into very worthwhile degree programs. But it's hard when you do see people going and getting degrees that aren't translating to what's available in the market. You have a very expensive degree and you're doing a frontline job. Well, most frontline jobs can be described in a few skills, usually under 10. And that's where I agree that if we can tangibly quantify the skills that are being picked up in these programs, we should be able to translate that in a more effective way. So we're getting there. I think we're on a mission to do that. We all the thousands of schools we work with are actually taking all of their syllabi and all of their course content, tagging skills to it. What are we actually teaching at a more granular level? Now we can start to quantify and map that to things that are valuable. But yeah, the degrees shouldn't go away. Those are still valuable. Like, we don't need to like blow up the college system, but we do need to be more precise with how we're moving, how we're moving talent, and what expectations are we setting with students?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a great thought, but yeah, I think it's a fun problem to solve, because if we can get people tied to the right education that's actually going to be valuable for them to move up in their career, to make more money, to, you know, prosper economically, like everybody wins. Like, and that's where the good benefit of the skills-based approach is, it's actually putting more power into the employees' hands. Because companies are getting much more specific about what do they need, what job needs to be done. And if we can start to map this across our whole organization, it really will make the talent more fungible to where we can put things. My goal is to reduce turnover within companies, which companies will have to do this because they won't be able to go externally forever to just pick up any talent that they want, or at least they won't be able to do it cheaply. And so if we can reduce and redeploy talent to new areas that are being created, if you think about the pandemic, look at how many companies just knee-jerk, just cut a whole bunch of people. It's like, well, then they ramped up where they found a new unique business opportunity and they had to go rehire a whole bunch of people to fill this thing. I was like, well, you could have saved yourself millions of dollars by not just knee-jerking and moving everybody. Let's see who wanted to move. I would rather reskill than lose my job. So like, give me an opportunity to at least raise my hand to go over to something new, and let's give it a little bit of time. And so skills kind of helps make that connection. And it's not that we're blindly, you know, screening people and then pulling them in and saying you're perfectly qualified. No, you still have to interview. You still have to make sure that it fits. But skills are a wonderful mechanism for saying, how do we reduce the funnel of 8,000 people down to maybe 80 people? And now we can save a bunch of time by not having to go through complicated marketing, complicated, you know, communication outreach to find these people. We're like, no, they should theoretically be in this because we've already mapped skills to our jobs.
That's fascinating. Do you want to do some confusion matrix, Mark?
I'll do anything you guys ask me to do. This is fun.
The confusion matrix.
Let's get confused. Okay, Mark, we'll follow Cole's great quote on stochastic terrorism. I'll give you an option. Do you either want to do the Waffle House, or do you want to know about Gen Z slang?
Oh, Gen Z slang for sure.
You're going to go for that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. My daughter's already dropping some new terms on us. She's 11, and I'm thoroughly confused. So I need to learn.
This is
talking about the drip.
Well, we'll see if that appears or not. This is a service to all of our fellow people analytics folks out there that may be confused by the next generation and the upcoming skills. You need to have these language skills if you're going to communicate effectively with this next generation. So this is Gen Z slang to Gen X or millennial slang. So it's not a direct definition, but it is a slang to slang. Okay. Perfect. Okay, Mark, first one, lit. What does it mean?
It's gotta be something that's exciting, cool.
That's lit. Okay, that's what we'll give that to you. That's either rad or dope.
Oh, okay. They say. Yeah, I'm a millennial, so I'm off.
All right, Cole, low key. What is low key? Something's low key.
Under the radar,
like kinda. Yeah, it's like kind of. Okay. All right, both of you. High key. We did low key. What's high key?
I don't know.
Man, it sounds Japanese, but it's man, something. Oh man, Cole, you got anything?
I have no idea. I've never heard this.
They're saying like seriously.
Like, oh, seriously. Okay. So it's like Valley Girl.
Well, what if someone's like spitting facts at you? Or say facts. Just say facts.
Good argument.
That's pretty much a word. Word is what they say.
Oh, yeah. Word.
That's mood. Like mood. Just say mood.
Is that like I get all the feels, like that kind of stuff?
That's pretty close, man. I feel you.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Something's fire.
Oh yeah, that's like lit, right?
That's like hot. It's amazing.
They're saying bitch in here. I don't know. Yeah.
Bitch is like the 60s though, isn't it? That's a little old.
It's super old.
Yeah.
Sus.
Suspect.
Like shady, I doubt it.
Shady. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. well, we'll skip this one. On God. Someone says on God.
Like you swear.
I'm not lying.
I swear. Yeah. Okay, here we go. Gucci. Something's Gucci.
Oh, is that like bougie in the past?
Fancy sort of fly. They're saying fly.
Fly. Okay.
Okay. Bet.
That's the new word for cool, isn't it? I've heard this.
Or like for sure.
For sure. You nailed it. Boy, I went to a University of Texas football game, and it's a longer story, but I was interacting with some actual kiddos, and holy shit, I had no idea what they were saying. It's gonna be bet, and like you guys like, oh, I'm not capping. It's like, I don't know what this means, man. Nope. I don't know what any of this means. Do you know what cap means? To cap.
I don't. I've heard the no cap expressions, like I'm not messing around.
Bogus. Like that's false. Yeah. Like that guy's capping. Okay, last one. Let me find a good one. How about a bot?
Well, Mark talked about build, buy, borrow, bot earlier. I don't think it's that.
That's going to be way too technical for the Gen Zers, but
I have no idea.
That's a poser. You know, someone that's like
just going through the motions. Okay.
That's one of my favorite words. I'm glad to know this now. I love the word poser.
Bot's
my new word.
Yeah, you got to recode it. You got to recode it. I don't know how that relates to NPCs. If a bot is the same as an NPC or not.
Makes sense.
That's amazing.
That's funny.
Thanks for educating. Well, we appreciate it.
Well, are we ready? Hopefully, we all know a little bit more now about our Gen Z friends and family.
We just etiquette. Well, I remember when we had Kelsey Colley on. She told us about Drip and about Riz.
Riz.
And so I was like, all right, I feel like I know what's going on now.
Yeah, you got the Riz mark.
Oh, I hope not. you can ask my wife. I don't think I do, but
I think that's an oxymoron, actually, in terms, right?
Love it.
Well, let's do some nerdery. You down to do some nerdery, Mark?
I'm game. Let's do it.
The nerdery.
All right. Where do you want to start, man?
Because we don't talk enough about AI on this podcast, I wanted to start with another AI topic. Yeah. So this is from the MIT Sloan School Journal. I'm not exactly sure what you call it, but they have an article titled Why the Future of AI is the Future of Work. And I actually thought that, I mean, there's some meat in this article, but I think the general premise of it is, if the future of work is going to be determined by what AI looks like, then whatever the future of AI is very important. And so if you want to know what the future of work looks like, then look at what impacts the AI is going to have on each individual job, each individual occupation, And those impacts are the most likely thing to influence the future work, because the last few years, when people have mentioned the future work, most of the time they were just talking about, are we talking about in-person versus remote or hybrid, right? But I think that this is the next phase of what the future of work looks like. Did you all have a chance to read this one and look at it? And what were your thoughts?
I didn't get a chance to read that one, but I do love, you know, the fact that we need to pay attention to it. Like, we can't just bury our heads in the sand and be like, this isn't going away. It's clearly affected all of our lives and it will change most jobs. I even look at how we use it today. It's like, I used to spend hours like writing up new content for marketing or for articles. It's like, well, no, I usually start with ChatGPT now and say, give me some starting ideas, because I'm a better editor than a content creator. And so I'm like, if we can get a jump start on content creation, it's saved me hours a month doing that. And then the better it gets at doing PowerPoints, I have to do PowerPoints all day long. So if I can get faster at that, like, it's certainly not going to like disrupt my whole job, because you still need that functional knowledge. But as it gets smarter, you're going to have to look for ways that you can effectively use it, but not fully replace it. And if it is replacing your job, like, how do I pivot even further to something where it's really bad at? So I think it there's certainly a disruption factor, but it's not going to be as sweeping, at least in the next couple of years, as people think it is. But yeah, I was curious your thoughts, Scotty, if you.
Yeah. I'm actually curious on what you just said there around like it creating a, you know, a stem for you to further edit upon. I have like a love-hate relationship, and I'm sure it's going to get better and better as it goes on. But I find that the general text that it puts out there is they can produce a lot of creative sort of stems, but I find it's a very narrow focus. Like, it's not as broad as you would find from other people.
Yes.
And yes, we have all in some ways become editors, and it does tend to make things sound better, but I still have a love-hate relationship with this Gen AI so far. I find that I spend more time just in the trying to get up and running and then editing than if I were to just write it on my own.
Ooh, you're good then, Scott. You've beat the large language model already. I love it.
Well, I'm a creative motherfucker. That's what you need to know.
I love it.
Yes. He was the predecessor to Gen AI. He's just a generative guy.
I was behind the computer.
Yeah, Google's got you plugged in right now, and they're just tapping that brain.
The two things I want from it that I haven't seen is it should automate data pipelines and data feeds between, you know, different systems. Like, why doesn't that already exist? And the other is giving it a spreadsheet with data. I actually did see a company, I think they were marketing this for finance, not for people analytics, but just having a spreadsheet with rows and columns of data and it doing a summarization with intelligence built in to saying, hey, this is what you should be doing in people analytics. Those two things, I don't know why it hasn't done more of.
Yeah. I saw that video as well, Cole. It was super cool. Yeah. Up a financial spreadsheet, give me the trends, give me the outliers. Data cleansing was my most hated activity when I was in people analytics, because you guys know this better than anybody.
What? Yeah. Crazy talk, man.
Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, we got to put these data sets together. It's like, oh yeah, this will be easy. It looks pretty clean. And then it's like, oh, that field's not right. We got to go write a calculated field. Oh, that one didn't work quite right. We got to go switch the format. And so 6 hours later, you might have something usable. So I agree with you. If we can do better data joins, better data cleansing, man, that would be massive time saving.
Well, even like a year ago, I was seeing people starting to like really dig into the Gen AI and try to experiment with it. And it was already doing multi-factor classifications very well. So like from a skills library perspective, say a person has these sort of things, here's all the sort of jobs that they may be good for, because like they got what you used earlier, prompt engineering skills coupled with your nursing. Yeah. I can't remember what you said earlier, that you would be qualified for these sort of positions. I mean, that's absolutely revolutionary. You no longer need a, say recruiter or a supporting recruiter to help sort of weed out these people and like kind of suggest jobs for them.
Yeah.
Or on the other end, like you have a university, here's all the skills you've learned. Here's sort of the experience you have. You should probably take these sort of opportunities, or, you know, like pursue these sort of career paths.
Yep. When I'd written an article a while back about why projecting out the future work is hard. And I think what we're hitting on a lot of those points. I do want to come back to what you were saying earlier, Scott, about, you know, the stuff that you generate is sometimes better than what it generates.
Yeah.
I am already getting so bored by all of the vanilla things I see written nowadays
that exactly.
clearly done by GPT or GT. Yeah, GPT. Yep. And just like, come on, put some panache in what you're doing, please. Yep. Like, even if you have the GPT, like GPT be snarky, do it. Do something. I don't need another start with emoji, write, you know, one sentence with three bullet points and then a conclusion sentence with another emoji at the end. Like, I don't need that in my life anymore.
Interesting. I will say that the writing is clearer. Like, it's clearer what they're trying to say, but it's just not as interesting. No, there's no style to it with years in exclusively the Gen AI to create content for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of boring.
Yeah.
Do we want to hit our next one?
Yeah, what do you want to hit, dude?
I was going to do the Ethan Mullick one. And Mark, I apologize. I actually sent you the wrong thing on this. My bad.
Oh, no worries.
But
I can flex.
Well, I mean, we could talk about beards. I think it was still the one about beards. Let's see. This is absolutely, well, it doesn't really matter that you didn't get it, Mark, because it's behind a paywall, but we can extrapolate from the abstract just like a grad student does anyway. It doesn't matter. So this is just a screenshot that Cole has up here. But the study actually examines the impact of AI on legal analysis skills of law students. And the results show that there's a speed enhancement of complex legal tasks with a large consistent improvements in just how quickly people do it. The quality of legal analysis imparted, I can't read my own writing. Quality of legal analysis was slight and inconsistent, i.e. not uniform. The benefits were most pronounced in low skill participants and higher satisfaction overall in the production of the task. But yeah, what Cole has up here, these density plots are absolutely amazing. So in the red, you have with ChatGPT. In the blue, you have prior, no ChatGPT. And you can see the, what do you call that? That's not the skewness. That's kurtosis. The kurtosis.
Yeah, you can see the kurtosis. And you can see the means, which I think that's probably the biggest difference, is with ChatGPT, everyone gets better. And there's a lot of compression above 3.0 grade point averages. Whereas without ChatGPT, you're getting a much more variance all the way down to 1.5 grade point averages up to 4.0.
That's the deal. The compression and bringing up the bottom end of the distribution.
Correct. Yep. Like, where do the distributions not overlap? They don't overlap with ChatGPT above 3.0, and they a lot more folks that are below 2.5 without ChatGPT.
Yeah. And that's pretty cool. And I've heard references when I've read different AI articles that it's the ultimate equalizer. So you can bring up folks that don't have that instant recall, like people that have photographic memory. So yeah, lawyers is a great example. Like, if you have a photographic memory and you can recall the right cases and pick out the right analysis, like you're going to be on that higher spectrum, but you might be really diligent and know a lot of things, but you can't pick that up quickly. Throwing in, you know, ChatGPT with that analysis, you'll still be able to refine it. And I think it always, I mean, you guys probably already have talked about this on past ones, but like, especially with legal things, medical things, like, we need that human intervention before AI takes over that world. I don't know if you saw the article where the one court case, the guy wrote his response with ChatGPT and it made up a fake a fake case that he cited, and luckily the judge caught it because somebody double checked it. But it's like, ooh.
I think they disbarred him, didn't they?
I believe they did, yeah.
Yeah, that's serious.
And that's also, yeah, just pure laziness. Like, why wouldn't you go check it? That's amazing. But anyway, it's, I love that chart showing that it can bring up those folks and push them into the higher effectiveness bracket.
Did you see the Air Canada issue with ChatGPT? So, like, they have a chat bot where customers can go in. I'll try to make this as quick as possible. And the customer had a question. So they offer bereavement if you fly in and, like, someone in your family dies. But the question was, if I fly, can I get reimbursed later? And their chat bot, you know, their LLM, just made up a policy. It's like, yeah, we can do this later. So they flew, they came back, said, hey, where's my bereavement? I want my refund. And they're like, that's not a real policy. What are you talking about? And they took him to court and all this sort of stuff.
Oh, I thought that would have worked. If that would have worked, I was like, I love AI. AI is the best.
new policies? I'll take it.
It's not so good at policy creation, or at least predicting what policies the actual corporation may actually implement.
It's too customer friendly.
But like one more point here. Like we've seen this in like a previous article with surgeons, that the lowest skilled people benefit the most from these sort of tools.
Yeah.
And those people of moderate ability are the ones least likely to use it because they think they're so good.
Well, think about it this way. We've always had this thought experiment, you know, folks that are in like L&D functions and talent management functions, which is, what if you could take all your low performers in an organization and make them at the 50th percentile? What would that do to an organization?
Yep.
And I think for the first time, AI might be able to help with that. And that's why I keep coming back. Like sometimes like I'm on like a really negative streak with AI, and sometimes I'm like overly positive. But when I think about those type of things, it always brings me back to, oh, this is a really, really positive development. We've got to be investing in this space.
And I know we're just talking about law student grades here, but this is a really good indication of the performance enhancements that can be seen, right? Both, not only from the mean, but like who's benefiting from it, right?
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, and you look at just how slow things move, like the legal system moves super slow. So if this could speed up cases, you know, moving through faster, I feel like.
I don't think the lack of AI was the problem.
That's but... a little bit of bureaucracy in there. And lots of, you know, but it won't reduce crime. Well, maybe it will. But
they need this in the publishing industry for sure.
Yeah, that would help.
Oh, my God.
They really could speed that up. Wow.
Well,
let's do the last one, Scott. I thought this one was fascinating.
This is really cool. The power of prediction, predictive analytics, workplace compliments, and business performance. This has folks from Stanford, MIT, and Toronto. But we love predictive analytics, but does it actually help? So researchers surveyed 30,000 manufacturing firms on the use of predictive analytics and workplace characteristics. By 2015, 70% had adopted some form of predictive analytics. And predominantly, they're seeing benefits to productivity and sales. A $460,000 to $900,000 increase, which represents about 1.1 to 3% increase than you would expect by chance. But the productivity payoff only occurs when predictive analytics is combined with either IT capital, educated workforce, or high flow, high efficiency workplace designs. So analytics is not enough, and it's why you see some companies not benefit from it. You need these complementary assets to actually reap the benefits of predictive analytics. It's absolutely fascinating.
Well, this is really close to home in the people analytics journey, and I know you were a part of this too at one point, Marcus. At one point, every team started, well, let's just hire a data scientist, right? And then the data scientist would come in for 6 months and quit. And it's because they didn't have the right IT capital, which I'll just call technology infrastructure. They didn't have an educated workforce that could actually use the insights that were created. And they didn't have a team design for efficiency to actually put these models into production and use them for something. And so they were just beating their head against the wall, and then they'd quit. Yep. And so it was when people analytics teams, and I assume other, you know, analytic functions, started to figure that out, that they actually, the organization started to get the benefit of predictive analytics rather than just a bunch of data science turnover.
Yeah. Yeah. You need your users of the data to be ready for it and be able to understand it. And what business decision am I going to change because I know this new thing now? And that's, you're spot on, Cole. We had that same flow happen when we hired our first data scientist. He did this really cool retirement predictive turnover thing. nobody knew what to do with it, how to use it. We didn't have a good way of distributing it, and it fell flat right away until we beefed up the infrastructure for how we distribute reporting and, you know, how we engage our stakeholders to educate them on basic analytics and how to read some of the stuff. Our first successful implementation wasn't until we tied the use of all the data science team to an exact business problem that was really hard to solve. And it was a really expensive problem to solve. And so we finally had the operational eyeballs on this. And they also gave us some investment to build some new tooling around it. So we actually built, it was a forecasting model for putting people in offices and seeing what seats are available between all of our call center offices. And it used to be a first come first serve sort of process. It was the Wild West. Whoever called up the workforce planning team first got those seats. And then somebody would be like, well, I need, you know, 60 seats in this city. And because we only have that type of call center people in there, and they would start to fight. And they're like, well, no, this other team got there first. You're going to have to figure out something else. It was a silly process. And so we finally said, no, we're going to put in an order taking system. We're going to show you what the availability of talent is in that market. We're going to show you what the current headcount is. We're going to show the turnover. We're going to do some light predictions around what seats do we see becoming available. And then if your order was over that, we would suggest alternative office locations for you to put those folks that would be complimentary. And it solved a wonderful, easy problem where the phone calls and fighting, you know, got greatly reduced. But it took the systems and the education to put that in place first before it was is successful. So I would say always tying it back to business value too is going to actually
move
the needle on that.
There's some fascinating work that economists do with, say, like box stacking. It's like a whole like different realm of like, imagine like the best way to fill a grocery sack. You know, it's like you got to put your eggs on top, but you know, but to be economical in how you actually use that space, it's really fascinating, like in a subgenre.
Can I ask a question about this? This is completely unrelated.
You love it.
Wow. I love the tangent here. Here we go.
So do you, or the people that you guys are in relationships with, have strong feelings about how grocery sacks are packed at the grocery store?
Mark's got the riz, so I'll let him go first.
Oh man, we luckily shop very rarely together. It's usually one or the other running the store, so we never have this problem. It flows over into other things of like how to pack the dishwasher and how do we wash dishes. Like what's the process there? Like that's where it gets tricky. But yeah, groceries not so much.
Facts.
I don't think I've ever packed a grocery bag correctly in the entirety of my relationship. I get a lot of notes about it.
That's
so cool. Apparently there's a way you're supposed to do it. I don't know what it is, but that's a thing that exists.
What? I mean, that's sus. How are you doing it? That is catching the ire.
I'm first in, first out. You know, I feel like that's the mode of efficiency. You get one, you put it in the bag, get one, put it in the bag. Apparently that's not how you're supposed to do it. There are very, and like even I've even gotten notes from the people who work at the grocery stores. I'm like, why aren't you helping me then? Come on. Like if I'm doing it wrong, but if, I think you're supposed to keep like cold stuff together and you always double bag milk. I've learned the double bagging the milk the hard way. Yep. But like there's certain things you're supposed to do. And I'm just like, it is beyond me.
Hey, Mark, where does a grocery sack packing skill rank?
Ooh.
As far as the skills of the future?
Oh man, we could look it up right now. Yeah, it's in there. Some sort of a grocery packing skill for sure.
There's like mechanical ability built in there, you know, yeah. A little bit of spatial orientation.
Yeah, logistics management. Yeah, it's
got. Oh yeah, I love that even more.
Yeah, Cole, we'll have to do a tutorial for you for how to pack this the right way. Yeah, you definitely want
some things. I'm okay not knowing, you know. But this is Mark. You're an excellent dude. This has been a ton of fun having you on, and I feel like you know we've all collectively learned something today. Before I give you the final word, Scott, any parting words for Mark?
Mark, you got the skills to pay the bills. Oof. What's going on? Okay, here, just a quick question. Napoleon Dynamite said he had what, nunchuck skills, computer hacking skills, and bow hunting skills. How do those rank in Minnesota?
Oh man, those are all useful. all useful. I'm a big hunter, so bow hunting will get all of that solved for you. But no, yeah, we never
even talked about your ice fishing. Like I used to do ice fishing all the time.
We talked about that. No, yeah, the kids love ice fishing. Like they're immune to the cold. They want to get on the ice. They want to catch some fish.
They put their ice picks on and like go take the sled out to the shanty.
Yeah, actually, no ice picks. We just throw on the boots and head on out. And yeah, it's such a fun time. The kids embrace winter, downhill skiing, all the whole shebang. It's fun to get out into nature in Minnesota and just embrace all the cold.
How thick does the ice need to be before you feel comfortable?
Usually about 6 inches to walk out on it. Some guys walk out at 2 or 3. That's real risky. You need about 12 to 18 before you start driving trucks on it. But yeah,
that's just building your organization without a skills based approach. That's not right.
Thin ice. You're just
gambling. Thin ice.
Yeah. I'm not going out on any 2 to 3 inch ice. I'm sorry. Yep. But, Mark, having you on, it's been fun. Having that Minnesota accent is just clutch. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you both for the opportunity. It's been a ton of fun, and I love what you guys are doing, and keep up the good work.
Awesome. Well, you've been listening to Directionally Correct, a People Analytics podcast with Cole and Scott, and today's guest, Mark Hansen. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Steve.
Hey guys, Directionally Correct is dedicated to you, our listeners, to help educate and entertain you on how to effectively do people analytics. By supporting this podcast, you are helping us continue to provide valuable insights and knowledge to our listeners. Please consider becoming a patron of the podcast. You can find the link to sign up in the show notes or at patron.podbean.com/directionallycorrect. Thanks for your support.